Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Griefsters. I hope you're having an okay week. Just to let you know, as I've been saying recently, we're coming to the end of this series. So this is the penultimate episode. There'll be one more next week. Thank you so much for your support in this series. It turned into like quite an epic one, which I didn't really expect when I started out in February to still be going in June. If you have been enjoying it, please do rate, review and subscribe. It means so much to me and really helps me continue to make the show. And yeah, and if you've done any of those things and you've supported the show in any way, God, just thank you so much. It still means a lot 5 years on, so thank you. This week I am overexcited, as ever, to be talking to the incredible, I mean, yeah, she's a writer, but she's more than that. She is an icon, I think. She is Marianne Keyes. She's an incredible writer. She has written so many books over the years. Most recently, she wrote Grown Ups, which we talk about a little bit, I think, in this chat, which just came out in paperback fairly recently, which is just brilliant. I read it in one of the lockdowns and it just disappeared. I disappeared into a world and I didn't have to think about lockdowns and it was really nice. She's also just brilliant on Twitter and Instagram, and she's just you might have heard her on other podcasts. She's just a really brilliant, interesting person. I felt really, really lucky that she gave up her time to speak to me. So Marianne came in to talk to me about her dad, Ted. So Marianne, we ask, this is how I always start the show, who are we remembering today? Who is the person you want to talk about?
My dad.
And what was his name?
Ted.
Oh, I love that
yeah,
name.
It's yeah, so like Ted Lasso. Yeah, and he died on the 15th of December 2018.
Wow, so not that long ago.
No, I mean, I was 55. I mean, how lucky am I that I got to have my dad for that long?
Yeah, but it's still, we say on the show all the time, like, there's no hierarchy in grief. And, you know, yes, obviously it's amazing you had him that long, but grief is grief. Like, he's still your dad. Like, whatever age you are.
Yeah.
It doesn't make you, you know.
And he had had Alzheimer's for a long time.
Okay.
So, like, he had been gone a long time before he actually died.
Right.
So, you know, it's a weird one.
When did he get diagnosed with Alzheimer's then? How long ago was that?
God, maybe around 2010.
Wow, okay, yeah, so he'd had it for a while. Yeah,
and he got, you know, he got slowly. I mean, it's that thing they say with Alzheimer's, that it's cascades, that it's not really a gradual decline. It's sudden drops of whatever the word is, cognition, you know, and then they kind of plateau for a while, and then it's another sudden drop down to a much lower level. Yeah. And he had spent the last 8 months of his life in a nursing home. But it was still terrible. when he died.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because I think sometimes there's that expectation if someone has been ill or something's been happening, like, oh, well, you knew it was coming. But it doesn't.
Yeah.
I've often spoken to people who the person isn't dead yet. So, like, they have Alzheimer's or they're terminally ill. And I'll speak to someone and they'll be like, oh, I'm ready. And I think it's different. Once they are gone, it is complete, you know, a door really permanently locked is very different to I'm prepared for that door to close. It's completely different.
I absolutely agree. You just, you know, people always say it's impossible to prepare. And I mean, that was certainly my experience. Because, I mean, I had all kinds of warnings, even though I was in denial. But like, in the end, like, I was told, me and my mother were told, like, that he had about 48 hours left. Mm. And I was initially horrified and believed it. And then I went back into denial. You know, I found out in the morning that he had 48 hours left. And then in that evening, when I went into him in the home, he had managed to drink something. And I mean, he had pneumonia and he was too weak to take the antibiotics. Like, there was no way he was going to get better.
Mm.
And I still decided that he was going to.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's that thing, it's the Emily Dickinson poem, "The truth must dazzle gradually, lest every man go blind."
Wow.
You know, we can only take these horrific truths in small little bites.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, we talk about that again a lot on the show, of like the thing with, I think it's similar with grief, of like, it comes in waves for a reason. You sort of feel like, oh, okay, I get it, they're not here, but I haven't really accepted that they're dead. It takes so much time for your, and that's why your brain goes into shock, that's why your body goes into shock, to protect you from,
to protect you from as you say, the horrific pain of it, like the agony of it.
So you went in to see him, that, as you said, that sort of first 48 hours. Were you there when he did eventually pass away?
No, it was weird. So on the Thursday morning, I got the call from, he hadn't been well. I'd been in to see him on the Tuesday. And I mean, again, this is, talk about denial. I was looking at him and he had always been sort of plump at the best of times. And I was looking at him and I was thinking, oh my God, I can see actually the shape of his skull underneath his skin. I mean, it was just so obvious that he was dying.
Mm.
You know, it was so obvious that his body was almost gone. And then my sister, Rita Ann, rang me and said, you know, Dad really isn't a well man. And I was like, yeah, I know, but like, he hasn't been a well man for a long time. It's grand. You know, there's no need to worry. And then he got a chest infection.
Mm.
It must have been on the Wednesday. And then on the Thursday, I got the call saying there was only 48 hours left. And it's funny the things you remember. So I kind of reeled around in, I mean, I suppose I did believe it. And then I was meant to be going out that night. It was coming up to Christmas. And on the way there, I realised I couldn't.
Mm.
And so I came home. I got a taxi home and my husband went on into town. And I realised then I didn't have my house keys with me. So I went to see my mother. And while I was with her, my phone rang. And it's just that horrible, horrible, horrible feeling when I saw the number of the nursing home come up. And they said, come in. And it was, oh my God, you know. So I was there like with the shaking hands and trying to ring my brothers and sisters. And also I'd come out without my car keys. Mm. And so we got a taxi over. I mean, this is the nice thing, like the home is literally around the corner from where I live. And it was very near my mother as well. So like that had been nice that we could always see him so quickly. And when we went in, he had rallied and he'd had something to drink. And that was when I decided that he was fine. He was going to come through this. And then something weird happened. I used the taxi app to get a taxi to bring my mother home. And this car arrived. And so myself and my mother got in the back. It was a man driving it. And And he said something like, the man said, how are you, Marion? And I thought, how does he know my name, you know? And I said, I'm fine. And he said, I haven't seen you in a while. And I'm like thinking, who is he? He was a man. I go to AA, I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was another person from Alcoholics Anonymous who happened to be our taxi driver. And I just felt, I just felt, oh my God, how lovely. I felt I was being minded. Do you know, there was this, you know, I'm not a woo-woo person, like I'm really not, but it did feel like I was being given a message that you're certainly not going to drink and you're going to be fine no matter what happens.
Wow. Yeah, I hadn't even thought about it from that terms. Of course, seeing, having to deal with that and being in a place where you are going slightly into that denial may then lead you down that addiction road again. And then someone was like, hi, remember me? I'm in the same position as you. And it was like, oh, okay. Like as if you probably even hadn't connected the dots yet, but the universe was like, we're watching.
Yes. And I mean, his name is Niall. He's the loveliest man. And all I remember about the Friday, I mean, we were all, okay, I've got one sister living in New York and I've two brothers and one sister living in Dublin. And so, and my mother, and we were all in and out. And I suppose I was still in denial. But then on Saturday, I went to my, I go to a regular meeting, like with familiar people. And I shared and I said, I think my dad is dying. And it was so weird to hear me say those words out loud. And I came home and I was very tired. And I thought, I'm just going to get back into bed for a while and just mind myself before I go over. And then my phone rang and it was the horrible number. It was the home. And it was the man who was, you know, my contact there. And he said, he's only got a few minutes left. And it was, I mean, that was horrible. But apparently he just deteriorated very, very fast. And the staff didn't have any real warning. And again, with, oh my God, the horrible taste in my mouth and my hands shaking, trying to ring my mother, trying to ring my brother, you know, trying to get somebody to collect my mother to bring her to the home. But when I rang her house, she wasn't there anyway. And so I went straight round there and like, oh, you know, the trembling legs and the, please God, don't let it be true. And, and so I arrived and I went down to Dad's floor, and I mean, it was obvious from the way people were treating me that he was gone. You know,
it's horrible. Like, that look, oh, you just know, don't look, you? Like, oh,
the look, what? The kind of the pity, yeah. You know, and the kind of and the staff there were really, really lovely. I mean, they were just really, really lovely people, but there was a distance, you know. I can't describe what it does. What death does to the people that aren't the ones affected.
Yeah.
It's almost like, I mean, maybe there's a respect that you have to do your thing, but there is also, I think, a fear that it's contagious or something.
Oh, yeah, massively, you know, massively. Like, I think even if you work in a home, you know, where obviously you must experience these things, it's sort of like this sort of base human primal nature, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, oh, they have death.
Yes,
that, like that
stay
bad.
Away.
Oh, no, yeah. Don't go near them. Like,
yes.
It's just something in you is like, oh, maybe I'm not safe. That's, I think, what suddenly your brain goes, oh, maybe I should be careful. It sort of like just kicks in.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it is primal. And oh my God, so we went into the room and like, he was tiny, you know? He had become tiny. And I forgot to say that it must have been on the Friday when I'd come out of denial for a while. And he was not conscious, but he was alive.
Yeah.
I was able to thank him, you know, for being my dad and for all the things, you know, for all the ways he took care of me and, you know, for all the worrying he did about me and for, you know, for the values he'd give me. Like, I'm so grateful that I was able to do that. But yeah, but funnily enough, when I arrived, all my brothers and sisters were there and my mother. I don't know what happened because like I was the point of contact for the nursing home. But maybe they were, I think my sister Rita Ann had been there with her kids, but nobody was with them when he died. And first of all, I felt very sad about that. And then I thought, no, I mean, he was besieged with us. Yeah. And I think he took his chance to go when there was nobody there.
Yeah, we've talked about this on the show before, and there's a really good book by a palliative care consultant called Dr. Catherine Mannix. I don't know if you've come across that, with no. The end in mind. And she writes about all these different scenarios where people have died, but she talks about it of like, some people wait for people to come in and some people wait for you to go. And the first time I sort of heard that, I was like, oh, of course, because... Yeah, some people want everyone round. They want everyone to be with them. And some people are like, no, I want just peace
and
calm.
Do this on my own.
Yeah. And I think she said that there's quite common stories of, you know, people sitting with absolute vigils, being there for like 48 hours, going to get one cup of tea, coming back and they've gone. And them feeling guilty, like, oh, I shouldn't have left. But the sort of nurses and people who work in palliative care being like, they were waiting for you to not have to see it, to not have to be there, you know, all of that stuff. So... Yeah, I think it is a fairly more common than perhaps we realise that they...
Yeah. I mean, for some reason I knew about that already and I didn't feel bad about it.
Mm.
But then the horrible, horrible job was ringing Katrina in New York.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. And mercifully, my youngest brother, Tig, did it. I mean, Katrina had a terrible year because Dad had been very sick in the April and he had been in the local hospital and we had a really horrible experience with a really horrible doctor who conned my mother into signing a do not resuscitate order, which the whole thing was incredibly distressing.
Mm.
And Katrina, I had to ring Katrina and I suggested that she came home. And then it was actually kind of wonderful because we were convinced, and I'm still convinced, that doctor was not going to rest easy until Dad was dead. Like, he was absolutely, he was so unpleasant. And he was so like, he kept making fun of Dad because Dad had Alzheimer's. Like, so kind of what use was he, you know?
What?
And we said, And we said things like, but like, until he got this, it was a UTI and then it was a chest infection. Like, until he got those sicknesses, he used to play bridge, like not very well, but he used to play them. And the doctor was so scornful of this, you know. So anyway, Katrina and I decided we were getting him out of the hospital and getting him into a home. And like, we managed it.
Yeah.
Like, we found a home nearby. We got him assessed by somebody in the hospital. We got somebody from the home to come down and assess him. And basically, it was like a heist. You know, it was like a jailbreak. So, like, he'd been in this home for 8 months. And I feel like we were lucky. We got those extra 8 months because Katrina had come. And...
Yeah, and she'd had that time, which she might not have done had you not had that sort of moment
exactly.
in April of like, oh, I see, we need to make these choices. Yeah,
exactly, yeah. So, I mean, God love her. So she didn't arrive until the following morning. And, I mean, it was so weird because very quickly we had to leave. Mm. I mean, I don't really... They had to wait for... I don't know, would it be a coroner to come and do the death notice?
Yeah, I think so, yeah, depends on, if anyone, I'll get emails but telling me I'm wrong, but if there's no one with them or they died in, if you die at home, but if they were, I don't know, I'm sure someone had to come and be official about it.
But like they were, it was shocking. I suppose I just thought that he'd be in that bed and we could stay there for as long as we wanted.
Yeah, of course.
But we couldn't, and then all the admin started. Yeah, like
the death min is
oh the death min yes or the sad min as Catherine Mayer calls it. Yeah, and it was so odd because it was the final of Strictly Come Dancing that night, and like that's something that I would normally have been really excited about. It was the year Kevin and Stacey Dooley won.
Oh, that was a good year.
And then everyone went back to my mother's house. I can't remember, did we have pizzas? But then people started on the Baileys. And I suppose people's spirits kind of lifted for a bit. But it was
That moment of sort of coming together, don't you? And then also there's that weird moment of like, well, this family aren't always in the room, so this is quite a nice thing, like we're all together and we don't, no one has to be anywhere, everything is cancelled, everything doesn't matter. So I guess it's a bit like the first lockdown, lots of people said similar thing of like, first couple of weeks you're like, oh, this is nice, you know, we're all hanging out, and then you're like, okay, again, like grief is still here, like it's the continuation. Because I think that first bit is like, we're all in this together, this has happened, but really what the pain of grief is the day-to-day, the endlessness that happens later, which I think so many of my guests and listeners always say, like, that, you know, everyone always comes when it's just happened and then they leave, and you're like, no, you actually need to be around longer.
Oh yes, like absolutely, yeah. And then on the Saturday night, around all of this time, I felt odd, lightheaded, and a kind of, I realised that there was a certain relief in this, in that, like, I realised how incredibly worried I'd been for so long, you know, I mean, and how I had kept that worry from myself, from knowing it consciously, but that, I suppose, I had known that when we moved him to the home, that it was only temporary, and it felt, it was a constant, the constant fear of him dying. And I mean, it had finally happened.
Yeah.
And my initial response was kind of, okay, here we are. I mean, I'm not saying that I was relieved he was dead. It was nothing like that. It was like, no, oh I my know, God, this horrible, horrible, horrible thing has finally arrived. And
you spend so much time buffering yourself from that emotion. Like, I just, that's the worst, thing that possibly happened. And I think when the worst thing does happen, it, at least you do have that, you can cross that off the list. Like, well, that's not something I need to worry about.
Yeah.
Because it has happened. It doesn't mean you're pleased or like, oh, woohoo, that's happened. It's just like, oh, okay, well, I don't have to do that. And like you said, especially if someone is ill for a long time, you've probably been holding that worry for years.
Yeah.
Did you then have the funeral, kind of, did you speak at the funeral or anything like that?
No, Katrina did. The funeral was on the Tuesday.
Where are you in the, are you one of the older ones or younger?
You're
the
eldest again. Yeah, but I didn't want to do the eulogy. No,
not everybody is keen.
And
yeah,
Katrina,
wants to.
She was absolutely magnificent. Like, she wrote this incredibly, it was entertaining, it was funny, it was warm, like it got him completely, like there's no way I could have done it. So the neighbors were bringing things to eat, like cooked hams and cake and the funny thing is, I mean, it was coming up to Christmas anyway, like, so there was plenty of food. One of the days we had to go to the undertakers and do all of that, and then on the Monday night they do this thing in Ireland, I don't know if they do it in the UK, where like the night before you go to the funeral
home. Oh, you have the body in the house?
Well, it wasn't in the house, it was in the funeral home. It was the same thing.
It's much, when I've interviewed Irish guests, it's common in Ireland, I think. And I think you might get it here, but it's not, it's not really a thing. And we did an episode once with an Irish comedian, Gráinne Maguire. Do you know Gráinne?
Yeah.
And she was talking about it, and this another comedian actually thought she was joking. Was like, that, of course you don't really do that. Like, you don't really have the body in the house. And she was like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's like, so I think it's not always known that that is such an important part of the Irish death culture.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mam didn't want it in the house, but we had it in in the funeral home. And like, thousands of Dad's cousins came from County Limerick, where he's from, and like there was such a turnout, like and of our friends, you know, people who knew Dad from when they were teenagers, like they were, you know, friends of the family and ex-boyfriends and people like that. And I forgot to say, my mother was only just out of hospital with pneumonia. And she, I was worried about her, because the thing was, the expectation is that you feed all the people who've come. And she had booked a table at a restaurant a couple of doors up from the funeral home. And I had to make her go home. Like, I had to go around and tell everyone, look, she can't come because, you know, we don't want her dying on us as well. And they were absolutely lovely, of course. But she had that kind of, that awful conscientious Irish mammy thing of, you couldn't kind of insult the visitors. And we were exhausted, like, you know, and Katrina is a nurse, you know, and she's, you know, she suits New York. She has lots of energy, but she was flattened. And then the following day was the funeral. And when I woke up, I didn't want to go. I thought, I can't. I thought, I simply haven't got it in me to do this. But I went, and I am so grateful that I did go, because it was sort of lovely. And what I found really lovely was afterwards, because we all went to the golf club afterwards for lunch. And I have to, it remind me to tell you about the funeral car. But what I loved was talking to cousins, younger cousins of my dad, who knew a totally different side to him than I did.
Yeah.
And they said things like, you know, he was a very serious young man, you know. And I loved hearing that, you know, and he was a very clever, studious man, you know, and he took his studies very seriously. And, you know, he was my dad, you know, I had it. But they were younger cousins who looked up to him. And that was interesting and nice. And people who were, and even one of my cousins said, you know, that he was, the dad was the straightest, most honest man that they had ever met. Like, one of my cousins, and I'm sort of being fudging this a little bit, he mightn't have been a first cousin, but he was saying that he was trying to talk to my dad to get advice on how to do something less than legal in the farm business. I mean, and he was saying, like, that's just no way. Like, dad just wouldn't engage, wouldn't entertain it. And it was just very nice to hear all these things. The thing was, a lot of the cousins from the country had come on the train and they didn't have cars. And so we were trying to organise cars to get them all up to the graveyard and then to the golf club for the lunch. And it was like, I don't know, the evacuation of Phnom Penh, you know, or like you know, the last days of the Vietnam War, you know, like helicopters taken off from the roof of the US embassy. So people were trying to get lifts everywhere, and like cars were jammers with people, like, you know, like four or five adults in the back of a mini, like, you know, this sort of thing.
One can get in the boot, don't worry, he's small.
But a family friend, Connor Ferguson, who has been a family friend for, like, you know, since he was 14, he was the last one left. So we said, sure, look, get into the funeral car with us, because, like, it was just my mother and the five offspring, you know, like, none of our spouses were allowed. So Connor Ferguson gets in behind my mother, and, like, it was a fair drive to the cemetery. And and we all call my mother Mam, and Connor has always called her Mam as well, you know. And we were all in stitches, you know, because Connor was there and Mam didn't know. And eventually he piped up and he goes, Mam, it's Connor here, I'm behind you. And it was just, I mean, Connor's life, I think, is very Curb Your Enthusiasm, you know, like, that sort of thing happened. But I liked it because it was kind of typical of us. You know, like, we're a chaotic family, and we like a laugh. And then it was perishing cold up at the graveyard, because it was like the 19th of December, one of them dates. But it's this beautiful graveyard, and it's new, so it's quite American and fancy. Most of the graveyards I know, like, you're tramping for miles through mud, like, you know, like, you're going, like, miles and miles past, like, thousands of graves. But this is, you could drive up almost to it, and they'd put up, like, a little marquee and seats, so that the family could sit, and it was all very fancy. And then we went back to the golf club, because my dad was a golfer, you know, when before he got too infirm to play it. And as well as all the cousins, there was a lot of people like, as I say, Connor and another friend, Emmett. And they had been coming to our house since they were teenagers, and they're in their 50s now. And they knew Dad when Dad used to have to, Dad would get called by Katrina, like at, you know, 1 a.m. to say, "We're in town, we can't get a taxi, you have to come and collect us." And poor Dad would put his coat on over his pyjamas, you know, and drive in and get them all. And again, it would be like 8 in the back and 4 in the front. And and it was just lovely to hear. You know, I really understand now the purpose of a memorial or a funeral or something like that. It's really, really, really nice to remember your person.
So important, it's so much so part of the process.
And you know, to think that I had wanted to not go.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
Well, I think you just, when you don't, haven't been through that, you just think it's just pain. I'm just going to cry and it's going to be awful, and you know, as ever with life, with grief, it's not all awful. It's all these massive amounts of things. And I think what you're talking about is so interesting, because it's that when you're in relationship with someone, you are only daughter to them as a father, you know, their father. And everyone else has something else. So you build up this sort of 360 degree picture of somebody else, and you're like, oh, wow, oh, you saw them like that, and they said that, and it just makes them really whole.
Yes, and it was so nice to see how loved he had been, and how respected and liked. You know, people who had worked with him, like, 30 years earlier had come. And also, I suppose, so many people showed up for me, and that also, I was so touched. Like outside the church, and it was just, you know, it was cold, but it was sunny, you know, and people had come from all parts of my life and from the past. And that was very uplifting.
I think, it's one of the biggest things I thought about this past year, about people who can't have that ritual and can't have all those people. And again, I think sometimes if you're not in the club, as we say on the show, like, you can be like, oh, well, they can do it later, or, you know, it's a funeral was, you know, is what's it for? And it's like, and it said, until you have a funeral that really, really matters to you, and like you said, you can sort of see the reason it exists. It's a ritual. It's, we've been doing rituals for thousands of years. It's not just like, oh, because it's, you know, based in Christianity that we bury our dead. It's like, no, people have been burying their dead for since we've been here.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's such an important part of it. And yeah, it's like you said, it's such a mix of pain and sadness and love and laughter and happy and all of that stuff. And I think actually it's quite a good starting point to grieving, because that's what grief is. You're about to hit this, you know, you're about to go on this journey of agony and laughter and memories, and it isn't just all those things. And that often is what a funeral can be. Obviously it depends on the circumstances, but tends to be if someone has lived a goodish, got to a goodish age, you know, excuse what I mean. So how was it after the funeral? Because often that is when everybody hits that kind of like, oh my God, because people go, people stop contacting you, and especially you've got Christmas, so everyone's kind of involved in their own thing. And
we had Christmas, which was so odd. And my sister-in-law Liliana, who is this fantastically able cook and hostess, she had us all over, and it was quiet, but it was actually lovely. Katrina had to go back to New York, but like it was sad, but it wasn't agony. I suppose, I mean, we were reeling, you know, probably still moving in and out of disbelief.
Yeah, there's a lot of shock that happens. And it's funny, isn't it? Because, you know, you are someone in that circumstance that people might be surprised, because it's like, well, they were sick for a long time, you know, they got to this point, but it doesn't stop the shock of someone just not being there.
Yeah, and that was the one thing I didn't know where he was. I can't describe it. It's just like, well, he's not at home in Mam's house, and he's not in the home. And I don't believe he's in the grave. Where is he? And it didn't make any sense. I mean, like, because he wasn't anywhere. Yeah. But I didn't feel that. I thought he has to be somewhere.
It's so hard to get your head
back. Yeah, it is.
It's just so hard, like, that literally took to be like, ages.
That took ages to go. You know, but even now, like, when I go up to the lovely graveyard, and it is a lovely graveyard, it's not him in the ground.
I mean, to go back to one of your earlier comments, when you see the body, I think that is the first step of acceptance of, like, they're really not there. Because like you said, it's just this tiny, tiny thing. And you see, and it looks, body without a personal life looks really vulnerable. It looks really like, oh, that's not going to work. Like, that's that person can't walk around the place.
No.
But when someone's living, of course you don't think that. You see them. And yeah, I can understand. My dad was cremated, so we don't have a graveyard as such. But yeah, it's very hard to, yeah, just where are they? Are you particularly religious? Did you take any comfort from that? No.
No, not at all. But that's okay.
I always feel slightly, you know, it's fine. I was talking to someone yesterday, another episode, who is a Christian, and I was saying, like, I always feel like I'm sort of standing on the edge. What do I mean? I guess, like, you know, like, you're all around a pond and you can, like, see them on the other side and they believe in heaven. You're like, oh, it looks nice over there, doesn't it? Like, it would be, but you don't, so you can't.
Yeah.
You can't make yourself fake it, but you're like, oh, look, they think. So if they were asked, where are they? They know, they've got this sort of firm confidence about where they are.
Yes.
They're in heaven. I think, oh, that sounds nice that you've got that.
Like, I mean, I think a lot of people have that belief until actually somebody does die and they find that actually it's not something that they genuine, you know, that they're not taking any sucker from it, because actually it doesn't feel real. But, you know, each to their own.
Yeah, of course, whatever works for you personally. I would never, you know, if that's what works, I just think it's, if you are, it looks, maybe that's really unfair of me. I suppose I sometimes think it looks easier, but of course it isn't. It's still, the person you love is gone, so it's not easier. So what did you come to your conclusion that where he was? Did you find any sort of piece of, like, I know you said, oh, you're not woo woo, but did you have anything where you felt like his, like a spirit, or you felt like this, or you just thought, I can't,
a little bit,
that's not how I see it.
He was very particular about the shoes I used to wear. He liked pretty elegant shoes, and I wear boots, and I had a particular pair of boots that had spikes on the front. Lovely ones. But he was...
They sound great.
Oh, God, they're lovely. But I tell you, he has hidden them on me. You know? Like, he used to look at them and he used to go, "What have you got on your feet, Mar?" He used to call me Mar. And I'd say, "They're my nice boots, Dad. You not like them?" He goes, "I hate them." So he has hidden them on me.
You can't find
my
them
lovely.
Still.
And they're Louboutins. And he, yes.
Oh my God.
And they are lost. I mean, I have torn the place apart looking for them. And
oh, Marion, that's so
isn't
funny.
Isn't it hilarious? Like,
that's hilarious.
Yeah, and they're gone. And now and again, wow. I try to find them. And they are so gone.
And that, he's like, "She's not. That is my, no. If I can do anything, they're gone. Yes. That's it. You're not having them." That's hilarious.
So I, like, so I think funny. That's him having the last laugh. You know, I like that. I really do. And I, you know, I don't, I just feel that he lives on in our, like, we talk about him. You know, my mother and I talk about him all the time. Katrina and I, you know, obviously we haven't got together in so long, but like when we're all together, we talk about him. And like, and other things happened, like my brother Tig had a little girl, Hannah. Let me see, I'm trying to think. I think she was born about a year and a half before he died. And after she went up, they took her up to the graveyard one day, and she has Down syndrome, and she's not pre-verbal, but I mean, she makes noises, but like she doesn't have words. But right, she was having this conversation, like you know, she was and laughing and like really wow. animated, and Dad loved her. Like there's a beautiful photograph of the two of them looking into each other's eyes. I mean, and like we're convinced that she was talking to Dad up there. But then, let me see, when was it? In the summer of 2019, which is, you know, 6 months after Dad had died, my brother's wife got pregnant again, and they had shut up shop. And after Dad died, my mother said, "Somebody's going to get pregnant," because that's what always happens. And I said, "Well, you know, well, A, don't be looking at me." And I mean, and the next most obvious person was my niece, Emma, who was like 19 at the time. And I was like, "It better not be Emma," you know. But it was Susie. And so she had a little boy called Tomas. And I am not making this up. He has some mannerisms that are like Dad. And he walks like Dad. It's hilarious. You know, like he's got that same little fella, you know. Like it's so, I mean, obviously, when you're primed to look for signs, you'll see them.
Yeah,
but like all the same.
And no, I totally agree. And my brother is very similar to my dad, but he doesn't look like him really. And he had a son and his wife is Japanese, so his children are a mix of Japanese and English. And when he appeared to us, he looks very Japanese. But the weirdest thing was, but all of us were like, "Wow, that's what Dad would have looked like if he was Japanese." Like, they look so similar in a way that, again, of all the grandchildren, you would have thought, "Oh, it won't be, obviously, you know, be less likely to be the one with the Japanese mother. That's obviously a strong genetic heritage." And he just looks like him. And he gives you this look sometimes. That's what I feel like. I get a look and I'm like, how do you know to do that? That is my dad looking
it's
at me.
It's guess.
So weird.
Yeah.
And it's, I guess, because I think until you've, like some people say, "Oh, they live on through you," which always sounds like, what does that mean? And then when you see it, you're like, "Oh, I see."
Yeah.
That is how people live on.
Yes.
Like they live on in this way that you can't argue with.
Yeah.
Like, it's just there.
Yeah. Like, you know, because of my dad, you know, there are 7 grandchildren on this earth, do you know, that are living their lives. And you know, he had 5 children. Like when I think of it like that, kind of the chain of human beings, like down through the centuries, it's like, it's a bit mind-blowing.
It is. And it's again that thing with grief of like it isn't just all wailing, and it isn't obviously walking around being like happy all the time. It's just all these weird moments that sort of connect to each other. And I think especially grandchildren are a really strange thing when you're not, you know, when you're the child in that situation, and the next generation is what I mean, and you're looking at them and you're like, oh, you didn't know them in that way. You didn't, I mean, my nephew never even met him, obviously, because he died when me and my brother were teenagers. But it was very, comforting to see that, weirdly. It felt familiar. I don't know if you had the same, like, oh, there you are.
Yes.
Oh, there it is. Oh.
It's lovely. Hi. Yeah, it's really yeah. lovely.
How did you find, that was 2018, then obviously we had 2019, then obviously we had 2020.
Yeah.
Which was quite early on in your grief, I would have said, when all of this stuff kicked off. And there was a lot of discussion on the Twitter with this podcast and my guests of, like, finding the lockdown very, not confronting is perhaps not the right word, but, like, how did you find, because you were quite early in your grief, did you find suddenly having to be, oh, I can't distract myself? Although I guess you're a writer, so you can write from home, but did you find it a bit,
that's a great word, I found, like, the first 6 months after he died really, really, really hard. In that, I mean, I was so tired. I mean, it was...
People don't realise how tired it makes
God.
You. Like,
yes.
Yeah, it wipes you.
Completely.
It wipes you. And then it's confusing because people are like, what is this? You're like, it's grief.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's not... I guess it's like... You know, these are mysterious things in life, like periods or something. Like you until you hit it, someone's like, oh, that's what that is.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, well, why does no one tell me?
Yeah, and I couldn't work. It was like I'd been given a dead arm to the brain. Like, and I was meant to have delivered a book at the end of 2018 and I couldn't. And I was incapable. And I tried, like, I tried and I just couldn't. And then in the summer, sometime that summer, I kind of, it was like, you know, when your ears pop on a plane, like it was that. I thought, oh, all right, then, okay, fine. Like it changes you forever. Another thing,
fundamentally.
Yeah, I mean, and it's something, actually, I'll tell you what COVID did do to me. After Dad died, I was terrified of everyone else dying. You know, like,
death anxiety. Yeah. They call it.
Oh, do they? Yeah. Okay. I mean, like, I mean, obviously, my mother is is a worry. But my,
once you've got one left, it becomes like, don't you die.
I said that to her. I did. I said, I said, you are not to die for at least 5 years. Do you hear me? And she said, okay.
Yeah.
which is very nice of her. But my husband, I used to wake in the middle of the night to make sure he was still breathing, or I would touch him to make sure he hadn't gone cold. And that has started again in this current lockdown. Just the fear, fear of him dying.
It's really common. It's really common. Like, they call it death anxiety, and it often happens when it just happens after breathing. It can happen after a shocking one because it's about, I don't know if you suffered from anxiety beforehand as well. Like, so I think I probably was anxious before he died. And then when that happened to me, it's just like, it's about loss of control again, isn't it? It's like, you weren't in control. There was nothing you could do.
Yeah.
And that is such a hard thing to accept as a human. There's nothing you could have done. It's like, there must be something. Must be one thing I didn't.
Yes.
And it's like, no, there isn't. And so you get into this like, well, if I obsessively worry about that person, I can somehow protect
them. That's right. Yes.
And it's, and I think the lockdowns, again, your control is ripped away from you, which feels like feels a bit griefy, and you don't get to see people, which feels a bit griefy because you're isolated. And so it all starts trickling back into your brain of like, oh, this feels a bit like grief again. I'd have no say over how I'm feeling about things. So if I just worry about them, somehow I can protect them.
I mean, I do that magical thinking worrying will protect them. But it's also like death is very close at the moment.
I
mean, it's a fact.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's something that I both am in denial about and I'm very aware of. Like, you know, you've got to keep going. But I think that's how it's affected me. You know, and I have spells of, I don't know, darkness or lowness. One of my big worries was about 11 years ago, I had a breakdown that was really tough. It was hard living through it. And I was really lucky and I recovered and and I have really been very happy. And I was worried that if one of my parents died, that I would, that I'd revert to it. And, and I'm so grateful that I haven't. But I suppose things are so difficult at the moment that it's sort of, I get hints of it. And they're only hints, thank God, because I feel like I'm not sure I'd have the stamina to survive another bout of it. But I don't know if that ties into grief or if it's just, I suppose, I mean, everything is, nothing can be, nothing happens on its own. Like every experience is tied up with every other one. And that's, the death anxiety and the fear of kind of going back into the horrors. And as I say, I get wispy hints of it now and again, but that's all it is, thank God.
It's so, you know, it's so hard. Life can be so hard, which I always feel like it doesn't, that word doesn't do enough.
No.
It's like, it doesn't give enough of what you actually mean. I feel like we need a German word to jump in there and do the job for us. But I completely, I really understand. And I know that, when my, that, you know, period after my dad died, obviously I was very young and it was awful. And I, the sort of, for ages I didn't go to therapy. I just completely was in denial. Because it was, you know, too young. And I remember starting therapy and my, I felt like that, I can really relate to that. I basically thought, like, if we open this box, it's never going to stop. And so I've learned to close the box. I've learned to cope. Yeah. I've learned to survive. So, and I felt like you, exactly like you said, of like, I won't be able to do that again. I did it once. I don't know how I did it. I don't know, but I did. And that doesn't, sometimes people think, oh, look how strong you are. You're like, no, no, what I'm, I just like, I just got through, you know, like Indiana Jones. I rolled through the door closed.
Yes.
It's like, I don't know if I can do that again. So yeah, it's a it is really frightening. But and that's what I found so helpful about therapy is having somebody there with you to kind of help you deal with that place of going through it. And obviously, it's we're talking about slightly different things, but to know that you can cope with it, but it's frightening when you've been through something that's so traumatic. It is frightening, and I think grief is such a it just brings everything up, you know, like it you can live your life quite calmly when there's not grief in it, and everything sort of like can, you know, someone can say how are you, like, oh, just sort of plodding along, but grief just like chucks everything up in the surface that was lying there, and it's hard to then find, like you said, what is just things that were there before, what is grief, what is pain, what is like, and have to sort of rebury all these things again.
Yeah.
And I mean that in a positive way, like not in a, like bury them down. I mean like in the soil of your, what am I saying? The soil of yourself. And I really understand that feeling, the wisps of something being there. Because that's what grief does. It just makes it pulls the rug from under you.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah, it rearranges reality. Like it rearranges everything, you know, my thoughts about existence, like everything is altered, and I don't think it can ever go back to the way it was before. Like it shouldn't.
No,
you know, we've been given insight into something that we couldn't understand before.
And we say that so much on the show, of like when you speak to people who aren't in the club, who don't get it. And it's not, because it's obviously it's not great being in the club, like, it's like but you it's no one applied to join, but you do sort of feel like you know something that some people don't, and it sounds like, well, I'm trying to obviously grasp at straws for what is a shit club, like at least we know something, but it is an insight, and you can't go back. It is a fundamental change, and it's just, I suppose like once you've had that shift, it rearranges everything. And I always find it interesting speaking to people who were much older, because for me, that rearrange happened at 15. So I've lived my life for a long time more in this sort of like, oh, okay, death is really near. But I think it must be a big shock if it comes to you later in a way. Like I dealt with that shock early on. Whereas if you've got into your 50s and haven't had that, then it must really make everything seem like, oh my God, what was all that?
Yes.
Like what just happened?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, because I can't compare it to anything. But I do feel that I was very, very lucky to have got to the age of 55 without losing a parent. I do. There's no doubt.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, yeah. But I don't know. You can, like you said, you only have your lived experience. And it was funny reading your book, Grown Ups. There was a part in it where a young boy described losing his dad when he was younger. And I thought it's really interesting because I really related to it. And I was like, oh, that's interesting, because I knew that you, yeah, your dad had died when you were older. And obviously you're a good writer, so that's why you can write you. These things that about people who aren't necessarily your truth. But I was like, oh, that's really interesting, because had I not have known that, I would have assumed you'd lost someone young. Because I was like, oh, the way you said that, of like, how did you describe it? It was like this feeling that you're waiting for something, like you're come waiting for them to come back, you know, like everyone's ready, you've got all your coats on,
and your
like,
muscles are tense to get up and leave.
Yes.
And you're sort of frozen in that readiness forever.
So I think that's the thing of whatever age you are, it's still grief.
Yeah.
there's different things that massively affect it, and I do, like, being a teenage griever, like there's all these consequences to that, but yeah, grief is still grief in that sort of more basic form. And I think it's interesting that you couldn't write. I completely understand that. I think sometimes we don't give enough it sounds like you did, but sometimes we don't give enough space to grief, of like, it's actually a thing you need to do.
Yeah,
like you can't be like, oh,
carry on and coexist with it.
No,
you've got to do it 100%.
How did you feel? Like, did you feel like you did it in those 6 months, or did you feel like it's still been coming back?
Oh yeah, it comes back. But I suppose, I think those first 6 months, it was intense. Also, I got very sick.
That's quite common as well.
Yeah,
Your immune system.
Yes, I think, I suppose, the 6 months, it was kind of all I did.
Mm.
But I don't think I don't think I can say it's done. I mean, I think it's always...
Oh, no. You just live with it, you know. I think that's all. And I think really it's interesting because I found the first 6 months awful, really awful. And I think it's a weird word, but I think it's like good that it's great that you kind of just grieved.
Yeah.
Because I think some people even avoid the first 6 months.
Yeah.
And that can be a problem as well. Like, I think you kind of need, if you are willing to go there for the first 6 months to a year, that can be a bit helpful sometimes, because at least you've like done your wailing. But yeah, it doesn't go anywhere. I mean, as proof of someone 20 plus years that I lost my dad, I'm still talking about it. But then sometimes I feel people go like, oh shit, am I still going to be talking about it? Years? And you're like, no, I'm okay. Like, I'm not wailing every day. It's just, it's still a part of my life.
Of course. Like,
I definitely, I said to someone the other day that my waves of grief, or those moments, are, they can be years between them now.
Yeah.
You know? And really, I can be like, whereas, you know, early on it would be like hours, days,
God,
months.
Yeah.
Whereas now it can go, years until I think, oh, what's this? Oh, I feel a bit, this is grief. Like, it's been so long.
Isn't that,
it really doesn't hit me.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that the relief periods have got longer for you.
I think it's a cliche for a reason, is that time does help. You've talked about it on social media, your grief, and I wondered, how has that been? Have you ever felt like too open to it, or has it been helpful to have that kind of
it's been so helpful,
other people's experience?
Oh my God. It's been so helpful, like, especially at the beginning when I couldn't stop sleeping, you know, and people just said, oh yeah, that's normal. Like, it was lovely to be told that. You know, and also people said things like, there's no wrong feelings. And that, I found social media incredibly helpful. People were so nice. And nobody said the wrong thing. Well, I didn't feel it that way. Yeah. No, I found it really, really, really helpful.
I'm glad. Yeah, I'm glad. No, I mean, that's been my experience, is actually when you're talking about stuff like that, people are mostly deeply kind and sensitive and empathetic. But it's a weird place, because social media isn't like that. And then there's this weird corner where everyone sort of gets serious and is like,
people were lovely. Yeah.
Well, Marion, thank you so much for talking to me and
it was a
sparing
pleasure.
Your time and remembering Ted. It was it was so nice.
Thank you. I mean, I really, really appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah, he was a great dad. You know, he was like a good, decent man. And thank you for letting me talk about him.
Oh, not at all.
And I'm sorry for your loss.
Oh, thank you.
I am.
I appreciate that. That's really kind. Thank you.
You can follow Marianne on Twitter at Marianne Keyes. It's MarianneKeyes. And her book, Grown Ups, is available in paperback now. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland and was recorded remotely from both our living rooms. Music was provided by the Glue Ensemble. I think that's it. Oh yeah, remember, you are not alone.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.